Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Nun Amud Aleph by the two dots. Amar Marzutra Breder of Nachman Mishmeder Rav Nachman Shtachov Hayotzei Al Yitomim Af Al Pi Shekatuv Bo Shevach Eino Goveh Ela Min HaZiborit. So they have a document of credit that is being brought against the Yitomim. Their father had borrowed money. The creditor now shows up and wants to take or collect on that loan from the Yitomim. Now the normal procedure for a creditor is that he takes from Benonit. But this shtar says that he takes mishevach, he takes from the best property. I mean, part of the documentation of the loan was that he has a right to collect from the idit, the best property. Eino goveh ela min ziborit. Nevertheless, he's still subject to the din of our Mishnah, which is that you're not allowed to collect from yitomim ela min ziborit. So that overrides the contract that says that he's allowed to, or he's permitted to collect from the idit. Amar Abaye, but it says, Teda, the Baal Chov, Dinei Bebenunit. I'll tell you that this is correct, because when it comes to a normal credit situation, then a creditor is allowed to collect from Benunit. Umiyat may be Ziborit. Despite that fact, when he comes to the Yitomim, he loses that right, and only collects from the Ziborit. Samalei Rovo, Hachiashto. How can you compare the cases? Baal chov dinei midoraita biziborit. A baal chov min haTorah only is entitled to collect from the lowest level of property. Kidu'ula. How do we know this? From the din of Ula, Damar Ula, Dvar Torah, baal chov biziborit. When it comes to the Torah law, a creditor only has a right to take from the lowest level property of the debtor. Shenemar, b'chutz ta'amod va'ish. So here they're quoting a pasuk with regards to a mashkon, that you wait outside, and then the individual will bring out a mashkon to you. Ma darko shalish lo tzi pachot shebekelim. If you ask the debtor to provide collateral, he's not going to provide you the best item in his house. He's definitely going to go to the lowest item in his house, and that's what he's going to provide you. So therefore, we see that in terms of encumbrance and collateral, the only thing that the creditor is entitled to is ziborit. Umatam amru b'alchov b'benonit. So then why does a creditor get middle-level property? Kadesh lo tino delet b'fnei lavin. That's an institution of the chachamim that we don't want to shut down the liquidity in the market, and people are going to be less willing to lend money if they think their collateral is the ziborit, is the lowest level of property. Meaning that in situations where there's a default on the loan, they're going to foreclose on this illiquid type of land, and it's going to make it more difficult for them to lend because they know that in cases where there's default, they're not going to get paid so easily. And that'll make them more reluctant to lend out money. Vegabi yatme, akmua rabbanan adoraita. And all that happened by the Yitomim is the rabbanan just set it back to the din Torah and said, don't worry about tinol delet bifnei lavin. Elohocha. But in our case here, Kevan the dinei midoraita biidit, since mina Torah the din is that he should collect biidit, afilu meyatmei nami biidit, then even when it goes down to the yitomim, it should remain on the level of idit. Right. So now, in this case, there are a number of things to discuss. First of all, what does that mean that Kevan the dinei midoraita biidit? Why is it that mina Torah this person has a right to idit? So the way Tosafot explains it over here is Nered de Savar Shibuda de Oraita. Tosafot says that he must believe that a shibud, an encumbrance, is a din min haTorah. So over here, where the contract originally stipulated that he would collect from Idit, that means now that he has a lien on the property, the Idit property. So then, even when it passes down to the Yitomim, nothing has changed the fact that he has a lien on that property. That lien exists min haTorah. That means min haTorah, he has a right to collect from the idit. And therefore, the Yitomim's status will not affect the fact that he collects from idit, because he has a priority lien on the idit based on his contract and based on the fact that shibuda, encumbrances, are midoraita. And that's why he collects on the idit, even though now it's sitting with the Yitomim, according to Rova. On the other hand, Marzutra, Baye, who before said that you only collect from ziborit, Tosafot says the savre miyat mei ziborit tzarech lomar k'savre shibuda lav doraita. They must hold that the lien does not exist min haTorah, and therefore once it falls to the yitomim, your right to collection is from the document or the necessity that they should repay, but your lien has disappeared. Now that your lien has disappeared, you don't have any entitlement to the idit. You get what? You told me give out. You told me only give out ziborit, and that's all that you're entitled to. First of all, that's how Tosafot segregates or separates between the two positions here by suggesting the nature of the lien tells you whether there's a din d'oraita or whether there is a din d'rabanan over here. That's number one. Number two is the contract here says that he gets b'shevach, that he gets from the best of the property. The question amongst the Rishonim, and here there's a heavy split in the Rishonim, is if the contract specifically states that he's entitled to idit, then does that work? Does that overcome the problems that we're speaking about over here? Many Rishonim believe if it's explicit in the contract that he's entitled to idit, and says in the contract, gam b'chayav u'bimoto, during the life of the debtor and after his death, that that's sufficient grounds to go after the Yitomim and get your idit according to everyone. Everybody would agree in that case, since the contract specifically stipulates that he gets idit, whether the debtor is alive, whether the debtor has passed away, that's enough, and he will get idit. Our question here is simply where the contract says he's entitled to shevach, but leaves out the terminology during his lifetime and after he has passed away. Other Rishonim believe that even if it's explicit in the contract, it's still subject to this din chachamim over here, that you get from ziborit. You're subject to the rules of Yitomim. Doesn't matter what you write in the contract. The chachamim overrode that and said that when it comes to Yitomim, you get ziborit. Doesn't matter what the contract states or stipulates. That's number one. Number two is the proof that the Gemara here brings in the name of Ula that a baal chov is b'ziborit is from this case of mashkom. Now, Tosafot already points out the problem with the proof from here. And in Tosafot's question is embedded probably all the opinions about what the level of a baal chov is min haTorah. So first of all, Tosafot says, "Pachot shebekelim v'hu adin k'shebali ten lo karka." Same is true when it comes to give him land. No ten lo pachot shebekarkotav. It gives him the worst of the land. Dainu ziborit, which is of course ziborit, aval pachot shebekelim hainu meitav. Tosafot points out that the Gemara in Baba Kama tells us that when it comes to metaltalim, everything is considered to be meitav. Metaltalim are liquid assets, and therefore, no matter what you give, you can easily liquidate it, and it's considered to be money good, shaveh kesef. So that means here, it doesn't really matter what the debtor brings out to you, what the debtor gives you as a mashkon, because no matter what he gives you, it's considered to be meitav. So how do you prove to, from here anything about karka? Because the mashkon that he brought out is meitav. So now you're telling me by karka he's going to bring ziborit? The two aren't parallel at all. So Tosafot says that it's a equation of not necessarily halachic equivalence, but idea, which is that the idea by the mashkon is going to give you the worst mashkon, even though that's meitav. By karka, so too, he'll give you the worst. There really will be the worst and have an impact. So that's the way Tosafot explains it. But from that, you get at many different opinions. One opinion is that when it comes to baal chov, he's entitled to idit min haTorah. We saw such an opinion in the previous daf, that there is someone who believes that a baal chov min haTorah is entitled to idit. That might come from here, because mashkon, no matter what, is considered to be meitav. If that's the case, then maybe a baal chov, a creditor, is entitled to idit. The other possibility here is, if the pasuk is talking about a mashkon, the truth is, b'chutz tamod va'ish, Aish over here is not necessarily referring to the debtor, but rather to the shliach beitin. That beitin sends in an individual to collateralize the debtor in this case, and to take out collateral. When the shliach beitin goes in there, he doesn't take the best, he doesn't take the worst, he takes the middle, he takes benonit. And so from there, some learn that the din of a baal chov midoraita is benonit. So from this pasuk, you can actually get all three opinions about what a baal chov is. Let's be sure that a baal chov, in terms of the din d'oraita, is not mentioned explicitly. As opposed to nizakim, where it's mentioned meitav sedeo, meitav kormo yishalem, there we know for sure that nizakim are done with idit. But the baal chov, there's uncertainty. What do you compare the baal chov to nezek? Do you compare the baal chov to ktubat isha? Or, here we see by mashkon, you can come out with all different possibilities. All of them are possible. It could be that it's idit, could be benonit, or could be ziborit. Here the Gemara settles with the side that it is ziborit. Therefore, we suggest that the baal chov, the creditor, is only entitled to ziborit min haTorah. But know that there are other opinions. We saw one before already in the Gemara. And Yerushalmi is even more explicit that there are opinions that a baal chov gets idit or baal chov gets benonit min haTorah. Once you do that, then this Gemara becomes a lot more difficult. And the question then becomes, how can the chachamim downgrade the individual to ziborit in these cases when you have a din d'oraita that tells you that you should be getting Benonit or you should be getting Idit. Tosafot back on the Mishnah actually addresses this issue and asks the question. Over there he says, according to the one who says that Kedubah is Doraita, then how do you deal with this issue? And then again, he says it again later on, by Nizakin, which are Adin Doraita, how do the Chachamim downgrade it to Ziborit? So Tosafot over there answered, Ikele Meimar de Sabre Shibud Olav Doraita, like Tosafot answers over here, which is that the Shibud is not Midoraita, and therefore at the death of the obligated party, all liens cut off. And since all liens cut off, Midra Banan they continue. Barmina Torah, they do not continue. So the Torah law is no longer relevant in these cases. Then afterwards he says, Inami lo polog Rabbanan ben Balchov and Izakin. That the Rabbanan made no differentiation between all parties and said that all parties are going to collect in the same manner. Or, in other words, they're making everybody into quote-unquote creditors. And now since they're creditors of the estate, they get what creditors get on an estate. That is, Ziborit. So whether they're working there with Hefker, Beit Din Hefker, or they're there to, in essence, protect the Tomim, because the Tomim have no way to protect themselves. So the Chachamim stepped in and said, you're not taking anything besides Ziborit for the protection of the Tomim. And that's even in the face, possibly, of Shibud Deoraita. So that's just a little background here, but in this machlok between Rava and Rav Nachman, with regards to whether, when there's an explicit statement that you get Idit, do you collect Idit from the Yitomim? That's Rava's opinion. Whereas according to Rav Nachman, you still get Ziborit from the Yitomim. Now the Gemara asks on Rava's position, Ul Rava, Vatani Avram Chuza. Don't we have, from Avram Chuza, Inifraim Inichse Yitomim Elamini Ziborit? Vafilu Hein Nizakin. Like our Mishnah, here the Braita states that you get only from Ziborit when it comes to collections against Yitomim. Vafilu Hein Nizakin. Even when we're talking about damages. So this is what I just mentioned to you. Damages are things that are midoraita, you're entitled to idit. That's metav sadeu, metav karmel yishalim. Vanizakim dina midoraita bidit. So then, what are you going to say there? Here you have a dindoraita. Nevertheless, the braita says that you collect from ziborit. So you see that it's irrelevant whether it's written into a contract. I mean, here it's written in the Torah, and we still say you get ziborit. The fact that you wrote it in a contract should make it no better. It says, Achamai skinan, Kohen Shaitan idit denizak kiziborit de mazik. The case over here is where the highest level property of the one who was damaged is on par with the lowest level property of the mazik. Rabbi Shmuel, and it's according to Rabbi Shmuel, Damar midoraita benizak shaminan. Mina Torah, we go by the level of property of the one who was damaged. So that means that over here, the mazik mina Torah should only be paying ziborit. Umrei tikkun olam. Like we said before, maybe Rabbi Shmuel is the author of our Mishnah, and the Tikkun Olam in our Mishnah is bid the mazik takinan. So the kinu rabbanon de mazik, that we take it based on the mazik, that means you give the idit, the best property of the mazik. The reason we gave yesterday was to prevent people from damaging other people or allowing their property to go out and damage, because there will be a penalty. They're going to come and collect from the best of your property. By the Tomim, they sent it back to the Din Doraita, that it goes after Ziborit, which is, according to Rabbi Shmuel, is what you should be paying over here, because the Nizak's best property was on par with the worst property of the Mazik. So the Mazik is going to give you his Ziborit, because that's on level with the best property of the Nizak. That's the Din Min HaTorah, that's been Nizak Shaminan. The Chamim elevated and said that the Mazik has to pay. Rabbi Kiva thinks that's Doraita, but Rabbi Shmuel says that's Tikkun Olam. That's only a din derabbanan. And so we'll say that Rabbi Shmuel is the author of this braita, and we simply took it back to the din doraita that you get the ziborit of the mazik, which is equal to the idit of the nizak. Where it says, ini, is that really the case? Vatani Rabbi Eliezer, niuta. Ein nifraim nichsei yitomim, elam niziborit. You're only allowed to collect from the nichasim of the yitomim from ziborit. Vafilu hein idit. Even if they are idit. What does my vafilu hein idit? What does it mean if they're idit? Well, if they're paying from ziborit, what does it mean even if they're idit? Lav afagav dichtiv idit b'shtara. Isn't it even when idit is written into the shtar lo, they still don't get it? Meaning that even if shtar contained the word idit in it, nevertheless, all you get is ziborit. And that would be a strong statement in favor of Rav Nachman's position over here. Where it says, lo, my idit. What is idit here? Shafai idit. Here, there's a major machlok between Rashi and probably most or the majority of all the other Rishonim. Rashi over here, it's a very large Rashi, talks about Shafai Idit is after the damage happened, this individual pledged or had edit that was available to pay the nizak, the individual who was damaged over here. The word shafai comes from the word like shefi, which means to slip or to go out of place. So shafai edit, according to Rashi, is that the edit slipped away. It moved away. What happened here is that the individual was obligated here in a case that he was a mazik, and now he's obligated to pay the nizak. He had edit. And Rashi calls it edit. The best of his property was now subject to encumbrance, a lien by this individual, and he should have collected from that property. Only little problem is the property slipped away. Something happened to the property that it was lost. Now, it's not that he sold the property because he has a lien here and he could go take that back. But as it happened here, some sort of natural disaster happens and ruins the property. So now, what Rashi claims is that once you've lost your lien on what was the priority lien that you granted, you lose all rights. And now you're subject to the stack and you go to the bottom of the stack. So here your entitlement was DDD because you were a nizak. You should have gotten the best of the property here. Now that best of property was what you had your lien on. All of a sudden that land flooded, was confiscated by the government. Whatever happened to the land and it's no longer available to you. It's not that then you drop down to the next highest level of land. Your lien is gone. Gone the gamre. And now you're subject to ziborit. And that's it. Kedrovo, damarobo, hezik ziborit, gover minayidit. If a person does damage to low-level property, he gets the best of the property. Shefai idit, kover min habeinonit. If that idit slips away, according to Rashi, then you're back to being a regular baal chov, and all you do is collect from the benonit. But gabi yatme, ukma rabbanan adoraita. And when it came to yatomim, they put it back to the doraita level of a creditor, which is back to ziborit. So that's what Rashi, or how Rashi explains the Gemara. There are a number of problems with Rashi's Shita. If you look, there's a large Tosafot over here, where the Rabbeinu Tam goes one after the next, questioning Rashi's position here with regards to Shefai Yidit. One of his biggest questions just has to do with the language, which is, the Gemara says, Mai Yidit, Shefai Yidit. What is the Yidit here, Shefai Yidit? According to Rashi, the Gemara here is not redefining the whole case here. It is simply saying that he got Yidit, and then it slipped away. And so it's not changing the case that was above, or the case that was brought in the Braita. The Rabbeinu Tam points out, according to Rashi, the Gemara should have said, Hacha b'mayaskinan. What is the case over here? The case of Yidit over here is Shefai Yidit. Whereas, according to the Rabbeinu Tam, he believes that the Gemara here changed its mind completely, and changed the whole nature of the case. And that's why the Gemara doesn't say, Hacha b'mayaskinan, but rather, Mayidit. What are we talking about here? We're talking about Shefai Yidit, which is a totally different case. What is that? So the Rabbeinu Tam over here claims that Shefai Yidit is property that is the highest quality property, but because of its location, it diminishes the value of the property. So for instance, you have property that sits on the bank of a river. So that property in of itself is high production property, which would otherwise be deemed to be Yidit in any other location. Problem is that the river has different cycles where it rises and then wanes, and it comes up and goes down and starts to wash up on the karka and washes away things that are on the karka or ruins some of the plantable land that's there. Or it's more difficult to work because of its location. Whether that's it's on the border of the river, it's on the border of someone else's field, that location makes it more difficult to deal with it. And that's why it's called Shefai Yidit. And Shefai Yidit, in essence, is Ziborit, which is, even though it has production levels of Yidit, it's deemed to be ziborit. And so what we're seeing over here is that even though they pledged Shefai Yidit, they have to still pay ziborit, which according to some means that when the Chachamim say you pay ziborit, it means you have to literally pay ziborit. You can't pay below that level. There's ziborit and there's something below this. This Shefai Yidit might be below the level of a ziborit because even though, again, inherently, the property is of higher quality. Nevertheless, the difficulty of working the land makes it maybe even worse than ziborit. So that's one way to explain it here. That what the Gemara is saying is that even if they are shefai yidit, you have to pay out a ziborit. Since the shefai yidit doesn't even get up to the level of ziborit, or other rishonim take the exact opposite approach, which is despite the fact that it's lower than ziborit, you can still use it to pay out the creditors, because that's the right of the Tomim to pay from the least value that they have. And this Shefa'i Yidit qualifies for that. The Rabbeinu Tam over here claims that this is a situation or a circumstance where someone damaged that property. For instance, someone allowed their behemoth, their animals, to go and graze on this property. So what the Chachamim state over here is that normally when your animals graze in someone else's property, that's called nezek. And if you have nezek to someone else's property, you have to pay them back be'idit, and you're subject to all the rules of nezek. But the Chachamim said over here by Shefa'i Yidit is there's certain properties where when you damage those properties, you're not considered to be a mazik, but rather you're considered to be a creditor. Because the nature of the property is that it's so difficult, and the way that the property sits makes it more easily accessible to other people, and therefore the damage that you do is not considered to be real damage, but rather a creditor. And that's what it means, Shefa'i Yidit over here. That the person let his animals eat from that land that was there, and when it comes to now compensating or restitution paid to the individual who you damaged his property, you're not considered to be a mazik. And you don't have to pay out of Yidit, but rather you're considered to be a creditor, as if you borrowed this from the individual. And if you borrowed it from him, you only have to pay back with Beinonit. And then he becomes like a creditor. And again, if he's a creditor and we're going to Yitomim, we'll drop him down into Ziborit. So that's what the Rabbeinu Tam says. You can see in the last couple lines of the Tosavot. Aval hezik Shefa'i Yidit, shemid sham beimotav lirot, gove min ha-binonit, t'lo choshiv nizakin. It's not considered to be like regular damage. T'lo hochi kaimi. That property, that's what it's there for people to utilize it. El havalek balchov. But he's rather like a balchov of agav demid shlomidat balim. Even though he did it without the permission of the balim, but the nature of the field being by the river is that people will utilize it to feed their animals. Now, they have to usually get permission from the owner and pay the owner for that. Here, the guy did it without permission. So technically, he is a thief because he did it without permission of the owner. But nevertheless, we're not going to deem him like a mazik since that's what it's used for normally. We're just going to consider him like a creditor. Basically, he did it, but he forgot to ask, so he took credit to do it, and therefore he becomes like a regular creditor. That's the way the Rabbeinu Tam explains the Gemara over here, rather than a case of Nizakin, but from that you see that the nature of the Gemara, when it says Ma'idit, Shafa'idit, changes the whole Gemara around. It's no longer even within the same world as we were speaking before. Rashi, on the other hand, almost connects it to the Gemara before, which is this case where he has it written into the contract, and then they have this Shafa'idit. And that the Idit disappears, or something happens to the Idit where you can no longer collect from that Idit. And that's almost why it's equivalent to the case before, as opposed to here, the Rabbeinu Tam, it's almost like an association. It's not really clearly connected to the Gemara before, or what Rava said before, because now we're changing the case completely. All right, now, the Gemara continues. Boy, Rava Chodvai, on this, Eini Ephraim Nechsei Yotimim, Elam Niziborit. In the Mishnah it says that when it comes to collections against Yatomim, you can only go after the Ziborit. What the Gemara wants to know now is, who is considered to be a Yatom? By Rav Chodvai, Bar Ami, Yatomim Shamruk, Tanim, O Afilu Gidolim. When we're talking about orphans, are we talking about little orphans who are below the age of maturity, and therefore they really need protection because they are minors? Or are we talking about even children of age who are Yatomim, but Takantahi, Davud Rabbanon, Gabi Yatmei? So there is a takana that the Chachamim instituted to protect the Yitomim. L'ktanim avud Rabbanon, l'gdolim lo avud Rabbanon. Rabbanon did it to protect minors. They didn't do it to protect regular Yitomim. Oduma, or maybe there's another side to this. Mishum d'lo masik adaita de malve de mitlove. A person who lends money never thinks that the debtor is going to die. V'nafle nichse kame yatme, and then the property will be with the Yitomim. Tavle noel delet. And therefore, it's not considered to be Noel Delet. So your question before, why don't we worry about Noel Delet Bifnei Levin if we always make it that you collect from the Ziborit of the Yitomim? The answer is, that's not within the purview of the lender. When the lender lends money, he assumes that the debtor is going to be around. That he's going to be able, maybe not be able to repay it. He may have to go after him to get the money or foreclose on him to get the money. But he always assumes that the debtor will be there. He doesn't expect the death of the debtor. That's something more unusual. And therefore, it's not a part of his considerations when he lends the money. And therefore, what he gets back when the Yitomim pay him is not going to be an issue for whether he extends the loan or doesn't extend the loan. And for that reason, Yitomim pay Ziborit across the board, because that goes back to the Din Doraita. And again, the whole reason to move it up for a creditor to Beinonit is to keep liquidity in the loan market. But the Chachamim are saying possibly over here is that this will not drain liquidity out of the market because nobody's thinking about this. And so even if you put it on the Doraita level and all you told me in pay Ziborit, that won't affect the liquidity in the market. There's no necessity then to have everybody pay Benonit after the death of the debtor. Hilkach, afilu gdolim nami. If that's the case, then even gdolim will be covered by this institution, the Chachamim, that you pay out of Ziborit. Tashma. So let's see. Detani Abayi Kishisha. The older Abayi said, Yitomim Shamru Gidolim Bein Tzarech Lomar Ktanim. That when we talk about Yitomim, it means even those of age. And of course, it's talking about minors. Quoting Gemara here from Shavuot, which with regards to a Shavuah, that if the father could have demanded a Shavuah from whoever's coming to collect, then we, on behalf of the Yitomim, tell him he's got to take a Shavuah. Even though the Yitomim have no claim over here, but they could say, if the father was here, he would have said, I already paid you back, or whatever claim he would make. And therefore, we demand a Shavuah from the individual who's coming to collect. What Abayi Kishisha says is that we do this on behalf of the Yitomim, whether they are of age or whether they are minors. So the Gemara wants to equate this to our case as well, that the din or the protection that the Chachamim afforded should be equally for Gidolim as it is for Ktanim. It says, V'dilim ha'ani milei yan shvua. Maybe that's only by a shvua that you make such a statement. The gadol b'milei do'avua kikatan dami. It's an expression that the Gemara uses in Shavuot, which is that even someone of age, when it comes to his father's dealings, he's considered to be a katan, because he just doesn't know the information. He's no different than a minor who has no idea what's going on. So too, even a gadol has no idea what's going on, because he wasn't there, he wasn't present. He doesn't know exactly what the dealings of his father was. And that's why we say that gadolim and ktanim are equal. Of all inyan ziborit, lo. But maybe with regards to ziborit, which has nothing to do with the Yitomim themselves, but rather the nature of how we view the Takana Derabanan, maybe over there it only was done to protect Ketanim, it wasn't done to protect Gidolim. V'hilchato. And the halacha is, Yitomim Shamru Gidolim V'in Tzarech Lomar Ketanim, Ben Lishvua, Ben Liziborit. The halacha is that Yitomim are Yitomim, doesn't matter if they are of age, whether they are minors, whether we're talking about Shvua, or whether we're talking about our case here of Ziborit. In all cases, the Yitomim are afforded the protection of the Chachamim, which is that if there is a taina that would bring the individual to a shvua, we demand the shvua and warn him to collect. And number two is that he can only collect out of ziborit. So that's the case. Now, Tosafot over here has a very difficult question, which is, when is there ever a case where you would demand the shvua and collect from Yitomim Kitanim? And that is because the Gemara states in Arachin that we do not deal with the property of minors, even for creditors or anybody who's coming to collect, we do not deal with their property. Elim kein ribit ochelet b'hen, unless there's interest eating away at them. I mean that only in a situation where by waiting you will cause losses to the miners will we intervene and then try to pay off the creditors. But in a sense where there's a loan that's extended and there's no interest being charged, then they'll wait until the miners have grown up and can deal with the situation on their own, and they won't go down and deal with the property of the Yitomim Ketanim because there's no detriment to waiting. But in the case where there's detriment to waiting, which is at rebeat, there's interest eating at them. I mean, the longer you wait, the more interest you're going to have to pay. In that instance, we will go in and deal and help the Yitomim out. Tosafot points out that the only case of someone charging interest would have to be a non-Jew. Oh, if you have a non-Jew, then what exactly are we talking about here? There's Shavua. Who are we demanding a Shavua from? The non-Jew? How does that work? So Tosafot speculates that the possibility that we're talking about a Goy who agreed to be governed by the courts or the Jewish courts or by the halacha. So that's what the Shavua is speaking about. That runs you into a separate machlok between the brothers, Rabbeinu Tam and the Rashbam, which is that you're not allowed to enter into a partnership with a non-Jew because that might lead you to demand a Shavua from the partner, and then he's going to take a Shavua in the name of the Avodah Zarah. So then you're causing the shame of Avodah Zarah to come onto this person's lips. You're causing a problem here because of that partnership or the nature of the shvua that will come out of that partnership. There's a machloket there between the Rabbeinu Tam and the Rashbam. What happens if it's already done? The partnership's in place, and now you're in a position where you need to get information from him. Are you allowed to ask him for the shvua at that point or not? The Rabbeinu Tam says you are, the Rashbam says you are not. So according to the Rabbeinu Tam, you can explain the case here where it's already exists. The problem is in hand, and we want to protect the money of these Yitomim, so we demand a shvua from this individual, even though he's a goy. And even though maybe he'll take it in the name of the Avodah Zarah, but still we want to know that he didn't cheat these Yitomim out, so we're willing to take it. But according to the Rashbam, what are you going to do over here? The Rashbam says you can't force him to take a Shavua there if you know he's going to take it b'shem Avodah Zarah. The Tosafot's final conclusion is that we're talking about a Ger Toshav here. Talking about a Ger Toshav who accepted not to have worship of Avodah Zarah, accepted that the court of law that would govern over here is the Jewish courts, and number three is that he's collecting interest from the Yitomim. And because of that, Beit Din will intervene to protect the Yitomim and say, please take a Shvua, and then we'll pay you out. And that's this unique case here where you would have a case where minors would be having a claim against them, and we would demand a Shvua from the creditor because we want to pay it right away. In any other scenario, we wouldn't want to pay it right away. We'd wait till later until the Yitomim were Gdolim. So to come up with a case of Yitomim Ktanim, where we demand a Shvua from the other party, Tosfot has to go to a Ger Toshav to get that scenario. Alright, next, Gemara says, "Ein nifreim nichsim shvadim b'yakom she'esh bnei chorin." One is not allowed to go after encumbered property when there is free and clear property. So that is another one of these tikkun olams. The tikkun olam is that people will purchase property if they know that when they leave behind sufficient real estate or assets in the estate that the creditors can come and collect from, that their property that they bought will not be at risk. If you allow the creditors to go after the person who already bought property, then nobody's going to buy property. They're going to always think that their title to the property is at risk. We have to give a mechanism by which they can buy property and feel comfortable that they're not going to get called by the creditors on that property. How do they do that? They leave over sufficient property in the estate. Or in the case where they know there's not sufficient property, the person will price it accordingly, knowing that he has risk that he's going to lose this property. But this is a way to know the order in which creditors will come and collect the property. By Rava Chodvai Bar Ami, B'matana, Heich, Takantahu David Rabbanam Mishum Pseida Delukuchot, Aval Matana Deleka Pseida Delukuchot Lo. Is this institution only for Lekuchot, for buyers? And buyers are afforded this protection that we don't allow creditors to go after the encumbered property when there is free and clear property. And that's it. It's for buyers. Or Dilma Matana Nami. Even by a case of a gift, Ilav De'itle Hanomine Lo Yoiv Le Matana. The truth is that a gift never is free. Nothing is free. The reason that he gave the gift is because this other guy did something for him. And in essence, it's a payback for that goodness that he did, or maybe a goodness that he's expecting from this individual. He assumes that it's a mecher, even though it's an intangible mecher, or it's not a stated mecher, matana embedded in it is some form of mecher. And so therefore, v'ilkach kipseid l'kucho dami. And therefore, we would consider it like buyers, and we want to protect this individual. What the Gemara is asking is this protection that we only go after free and clear property before encumbered properties, is a protection only afforded to the kuchot, buyers, because we want to protect the market and allow people to purchase land without being at risk all the time, or know how to price the land because they know it will be at risk, or is this a protection afforded to any type of interactions where land is given to another party, including a matana, including a gift? And therefore, even for people who are giftees who received a gift, they will be afforded the protection that the creditors have to go after the free and clear property before they come after their property, so they know that their gift is going to be kept by them. Basic nature of the question is, who are we worried about here, or who are we protecting here? Are we protecting the kuchot, the buyers of the property? Is that only true by the kuchot that they came in and protected the kuchot at the expense of the creditors? So, are we protecting the creditors at the expense of the recipients of the matanot? Or are we protecting the receivers or the recipients of the matanot at the expense of the creditors? And the balance between those two is what's the subject of the Gemara's question over here. And therefore, what is the Takanat Chachamim here? Is it to protect the recipients at the expense of the creditors? So is it only relevant to protect individuals who are purchasing property? Amalei Mark Shisha, Breder of Chisto, Ravashi, Tashma. Come on in from this case. Shchiv Meira Shamar. Shchiv Meira that says, Tznu Matayim Zuz Leploni, V'Gimel Meot Leploni, V'Dalad Meot Leploni. Person says on his deathbed, he's giving his last will and testament, and he says, give 200 zuz to so-and-so, 300 zuz to so-and-so, and 400 zuz to so-and-so. Ein umrim kol hakodem bashtar zacha. We don't say here that there's any order to the gifts. We don't say that, oh, the guy who he said first, who gets the 200, he is the first claimant over here. Then it goes down to the second claimant, the third claimant. Lefikach yatza alav shtar chov, govem mikulan. But in that case, if a shtar chov comes out on them, then he can collect from all of them on a yachasi basis, on a relative basis. That means that the person who has 200 will be on the hook for 2 out of 9 of the value of the creditor that's coming. The one who has 3 pays a third, and the one who has the 400, he will supply 4 out of 9 for the creditor. So what will happen is that the creditor will come in and collect whatever money he is owed, and then they'll re-divide the estate between these three parties based on their relative claims. One has a claim of 200, one has a claim of 300, one has a claim of 400. And that's the way you will deal with it. We don't assume that just because you were mentioned first in the shtar or here that you get priority in claim. That's because, very simply, it's this week's parsha we just said, Zachor v'shamor ne'emru b'dibor achad. You can't say Zachor and Shamor in one word. So when you write it down, you have to write them separately, even though they were said together. So to over here, there's no way for a guy to express this without having one be first, second, or third. That doesn't mean he's giving priority to one of them, but he has to say it sequentially. And that doesn't have impact. Tosafot points out over here, if it's the same amount of money, if they all got 200, then this would dictate that it is sequential, and that would be the priority, because otherwise he could have just said, so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so all get 200. The fact that he didn't lump them together and says, so-and-so gets 200, then so-and-so gets 200, then so-and-so gets 200, means that he's giving order priority then, because he could have said it, or he could have contracted it into a single statement. The fact that he broke it up shows you priority. Over here, he can't contract into a single statement because there's different amounts that he's giving to each party. So he breaks it out, not to give you a priority in terms of who gets the claim, but simply to explain what the distribution is. Aval Amar, if he says, Snumatayim Zuz Leploni, Ve'acharav Leploni, Ve'acharav Leploni, then if he says, give this money to this one, and then after him to the other one, then Omrim, Kolakodem Bishtar Zacha. Then whoever's first in the shtar has a higher priority, because he's making it clear that that's a residual. The first person gets his claim. Then if there's residual, it goes to the next, residual to the next. The fikach gets alav shtar chov. If a creditor now shows up, govem min acharon, he collects from the last party first. Ein lo, if then the last party's gift is not sufficient to cover the loan, then govem min shafanav. Then he goes after the second person's gift. Ein lo, if there's not sufficient monies between the latter two gifts, then govem milishafane lefanav. Then he goes to even the first party who got the gift, meaning that it's a sequential, there's an order of priority. The last one who got the gift is the most exposed to the creditor. Va'afagav dekama benonit ubatra ziborit. And what he says over here is, even if the first giftee received benonit property, and the last giftee received ziborit property, a creditor is entitled to benonit. So if you believe by the cases of gifts that we don't have this institution of the Chachamim, that you go after free and clear property first, and then after encumbered property, then the order here should not matter. The creditor should go after the benonit first, because that's what he's entitled to. And the first giftee received benonit. So he shouldn't have to go to the last person, then the next to last, and then the first person. He should just go to the first person and say, you have benonit, I'm taking that property. The fact that we demand that he takes it from the last party first shows you, mi ziborot gavi, mi benonit lo gavi. He goes after, he gets ziborit and not benonit, meaning he goes after free and clear property and then only after the encumbered property. Well, in this case, the first giftee received his property. When he received his property, there was still free and clear property. The second one received his gift. He's also free and clear property after him that was given to the third giftee. That means that there was always free and clear property afterwards, and that's why you go in sequential order. You go after the last give one first, and then to the second to last, and then to the first guy because of that. That shows you that the institution of Chachamim applies even in this instance. So now Gemara says, Shmamina b'matana nami avud rabbanon takanta. From this you would conclude that this takanat Chachamim, that you go after free and clear property first, is applicable even by a matana, not just by likuchot. So even though, as Tosfot points out, you could be mechalek b'chein a matanat shivch mishar matanot, you could over here and say that this is different, because here we're talking about last will and testament, we're talking about a different type of gift than normal gifting. This is not regular gifting, this is gifting on one's deathbed. So what you have to say here is that either we don't make such a distinction, or you say over here that the matanat shivch mishar over here was not a full gifting of all of his property. And he gave it as a portion of his property away, which makes it not like a shechiv meirah, but rather like a matanat bari, like a person who's gifting his property. Matanat shechiv meirah only applies when he gives away all of his property. Because then we know, or Anan Sadeh, that he thinks he's going to pass away. That's why he's giving away all of his property. If he gives away some of his property, that means that he still thinks in his mind that he's not going to pass away, and that he wants to keep some of that property. If that's the case, then his matanah is like a matanat bari. And maybe that's the case over here. Tosfos is trying to figure out how you can come up with a case that's not really a matanat shechiv meirah. And because of that, you can then extrapolate that to all matanot and not say this is unique to a matanat shchiv meira. So Mara says, Alchav mayaskinan b'bal chov. Now the case here is when we're talking about creditors, that the money he was giving out was not gifting it to these individuals that he was so nice to, but rather these are creditors of his. And he's saying, pay that creditor 200, pay that creditor 300. Mara says, v'atshnu kamar. It says, give it to them. Give it to them is not repay. That means gift it to them. Mara says, shnu b'chovo. That means give for my debt, my outstanding debts, pay them back. Mara says, v'lichsei shtar deman kodim. In that case, if you're talking about creditors, then all you need to do is look at which creditor came first. Meaning that the liens on the property here and who you collect from has to do with who had the outstanding loan first. Just go back to the original credit documents and figure out the order. Mara says, v'lichsei shtar. It's a case where this is all milveh al peh. These are all oral loans, and therefore there's no dating of the loans. So we can't check, and we can't look up. There's no way to know when the loans were given or where they are relative to each other. Mara says, kol hakodem b'shtar kamar. Doesn't it say that whoever's first in the shtar gets paid first or is the last one that you collect from? Mara says, b'shtar pakadito. No, it doesn't mean a shtar, meaning the creditor's document, rather. It's the shtar of the tzavo of the shchiv meira. What's documented, what the shchiv meira said is documented now in a document. And that shtar pakadata says, give to so-and-so this, give to so-and-so this, give to so-and-so this. That shtar pakadata tells you what you're supposed to give to individual. But that's not a dated shtar of the creditors. Vibai tema, afilo matana nami. Even if it was a gift, we're going back now to the original thought that we're talking about gifts here. Lokasha, my gova min acharon. Where do we say that he collects from the acharon? Ein nifsad el acharon. The loser here is the last one who received the gift. That is because even if you believe that the Chachamim did not institute this rule that you go after free and clear property first, nevertheless, if he goes after the Beinonit and he takes it from the first giftee, he takes away the Beinonit, then you know what the first giftee is going to do? He's going to go to the second giftee and say, I have first priority on getting my gift. Give me your property. The second giftee will go to the last giftee and say, I have priority in front of you to get land and I'll take it. So in the end, the person who's going to lose for sure is the acharon. The question is, how's that happen? Do you just go directly to him and take away his property? Or do you take away from one of the other parties and then those parties go after the acharon? But in the end, the acharon is the one who loses. So maybe that's the meaning of what is taught here in this braita, which is that not that whether you take from the Beinonit or Ziborit, it's simply that the last guy is the loser over here because he has the lowest form of claim. And so even if you take away Beinonit from the first party, you're still going to go back after the Acharon to get the property. Who says the case here is where the first guy got Beinonit and the last guy got Ziborit? It could be a case where all three giftees got the same level of property. If that's the case, you can't prove anything from this case as to priority. The reason he went after the last guy is because he's no different than the first guy in terms of quality of property. And therefore, there's no change in that. Emotzim l'achilat peirot. So this goes to the latter part of the Mishnah, which says in terms of the tikkun olam that is associated here, that we don't allow you to collect from encumbered property for achilat peirot, for shevach karkot, and for mezonot isha ubita. Gemara wants to know, my taima. What's the reason over here that you can't go after these items? Because they are not explicitly written. This goes back to the idea of why a shtar, or a written document, allows one to take from encumbered property. And that is because kala itle, that it is a publicized matter. Remember again, in their day, there is no titles associated with land, and you can't go do a title search to make sure that there's no liens on the land and there's nobody who has a claim here. The only way you would know that if it was publicized the issue. So here, how do you publicize the issue? The Gemara tells us in many places that when it's documented in a shtar and a deemed sign on the shtar, that's something that gets publicity. And since it gets publicity, it's something that will be well known. It's the equivalent of a title search. It's a way to know that there are liens on this property. And so what the Gemara is saying over here, that these items are not documented in the shtar, therefore they don't have a kala, and there's no way for the buyers to be aware of the fact that there is something like this that exists. Rashi points out over here that what the Gemara says here is not necessarily true, because the document might state in it, and Rashi brings the language from the documents by a transaction that involves the selling of a land, that over there the person warranties the land for the land itself, and all the perot and everything else that is associated with it. Which says, Ana ikum v'achve zvina ilein inun v'amalehon v'shvacheon u'peredidon. So all these items are mentioned in the contract. What Rashi notes is that those are just generic statements in the contract. They have no value associated with them because at the time that the loan is extended or at the time that he sells the land to the individual, all that is there is the land itself. What he says is that in the future, I will warranty anything that happens with this land. That means including peyrot, shevach, anything else that happens with the land. But at the time of the writing of the contract, none of that exists. So when you say kali idluhu, that's not true. It has a call that the land was sold. But as far as these other items, which are future profits of the land or future issues for the land, which he warranties, none of that is quantified at the time of the extension of the loan or of the selling of the property. And therefore, even though it's included in writing in the contract, it's included as a generic statement. It's not including a quantified amount that he will warranty. And for that reason, it doesn't have a kala. It's not something that you can say people should be aware of. So Amalei Rabbi Avalulov, Amazoni Shava Banot Kaman Kentive Domo. So now what are you going to tell me when it comes to the mizonot of a woman and her daughters? I mean, after the husband passes away, the woman is entitled to get mizonot out of the estate, and the daughters are, until they get married, entitled to get mizonot out of the estate. And we say that those are also things that you cannot take out of encumbered property. But there it is written in the contract. It's written in the ketubah. And even if it's not written in the ketubah, it's a tenai of the ketubah, which makes it as if it is written. Biktani ain motzin. And our Mishnah says, still you can't take it out. So writing can't be the issue over here. And as Tosafot points out over here, the question here is only about the isha and not about the banot. Because at the time the ketubah is written, the person has no idea how many daughters he will have or whether they're relevant at all. The only one that's relevant is the isha, who is mamashit at the time of the writing of the ketubah. And therefore the question is really from that, where you have it written down and yet still you're not allowed to collect it from the encumbered property. That question would really derive from the isha, not from the bat. That this is the way that the Chachamim originally made the tekana. They're as if written in the ketubah for free and clear property. They are not written in the ketubah for encumbered property. That's the nature of the Tekanat Rabbanan that made it a part of the Tnayei Ketubah, is that you can only take from free and clear property, you can't take from encumbered property. Because they're not written down, that's why you're not entitled to take from encumbered property, because people will not be aware or know to watch out for this. They are Tnayei Beitin as if they're written in the Ketubah. And still there we say you're not allowed to go after encumbered property. That is the nature of the original takana, which that they're considered to be written for free and clear property. They're not considered to be written for encumbered property. Rabbi Chanina Amar Lefish Ein Kitzuvim. He disagrees and says the reason why you cannot collect on these items from encumbered property is because they have no limit. They are not quantifiable. These have the possibility of becoming an unlimited burden on the estate. And then again, it would shut down the market for purchases. No lekuach would come in and buy property knowing that he's at risk of losing this property because, yes, he left enough free and clear property for all of this guy's outstanding loans and outstanding obligations. But down the road, maybe his wife and daughters were going to eat mizonot, and we have no idea how long they're going to live or when he's going to pass away. And therefore, it becomes this unlimited obligation on the estate, which could go back against the lekuchot. People are not going to buy property with that possibility, meaning that they're not going to be willing to engage in transactions where there's a possibility that they're going to lose the property because of some unquantifiable amount. People are willing to quantify risk. If they know what the numbers are and they can quantify the risk, they'll pay accordingly for that risk. But if the risk is unlimited or there's no way to quantify the risk, there's no way that they're going to transact. And that means people will stop transacting or you're going to ruin the market for sales. And for that reason, we say, since they are not katsuv, since they are not limited in any way, we will not allow you to go after encumbered property. Ibailu the Rabbi Chanina. According to Rabbi Chanina, we ask, tzuvim viktuvim boi? Do they have to be both quantifiable and written down in order to go after encumbered property? Or is being quantified sufficient even if they are not written down? Rashi over here claims that maybe Rabbi Chanina believes that Rabbi Chanina believes that a oral loan would be able to go after encumbered property as long as the number was quantifiable. Tosafot rejects this understanding of Rashi because he says nobody believes that an oral loan you can go after encumbered property for exactly the reason that we've spoken about until now, which is that there's no way for the buyers to be aware of these issues. They can only be aware of things that are publicly known. Things that are publicly known are items that were signed into a document. And that's why we say when they're signed into a document, it's well known. And if it's well known, then we can blame the kuchot for not doing their title search, for not knowing about these other obligations. Vein Nira Tosfot says about Rashi's explanation, here we're not talking about a loan, but other items that have fixed or quantifiable amounts. For instance, if a woman brings a daughter from a previous marriage into this marriage, and the stepfather here guarantees to give her mizonot for the next 5 years. So over there, he made a quantifiable dedication or obligation towards this daughter. It's only for 5 years. It's her mizonot. So there it's quantifiable. Do we say that that's enough of a reason to allow them to go after encumbered property? Or do we say, since it wasn't written down, that agreement is not considered to be public? And the reason being, the reason that when you have an oral loan, we don't allow you to go after encumbered property is because people try to hide when they borrow money. It's something that is not favorable for them, not for their credit standing, and not for their ability to sell property. And therefore, they hide the fact that they borrowed money. So in that case, unless it's in a contract, we don't blame the lukuchot, or we don't expect the lukuchot to know about it. On the other hand, when it comes to sales, when someone sells something, they sell it in public. And so over here, when they have this agreement about the mizonot of this daughter, or other transactions where the transactions are made public because that's the nature of transactions. People don't mind talking about these transactions, and therefore it'll be something that's within the public sphere. And you can say, look, you should have known about this because this is not something that a person would hide. So that's the way the Rabbeinu Tam views this case or the questionnaire. It's nothing about milveh al-peh. It has nothing to do with oral loans, like Rashi says, but rather about situations where you have fixed amounts that he obligates himself in, or there were transactions for fixed amounts. Do we expect the lekuchot to know that in that case? Because they were not written down. And the reason the Gemara asked this question on Rabbi Chanina and not on Reish Lakish or Rabbi Yochanan is because Rabbi Chanina follows those positions. And so the question is Rabbi Chanina bringing a totally new answer of Ktsuvim? Or is he adding on to the previous answer of Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish that not only Ktuvim, but Ktsuvim, which would then answer the problem of Mizonot, Isha, and Banot, as to why even though they're written, they're still problematic, is because they're Inam Ktsuvim. So is he answering just that question? Or is he giving a general principle about what determines whether you can go after encumbered property or not? And therefore, Inam Ktsuvim would be it, nothing to do with Ktiva. And that's what leads to this question about whether it's only when they're ktuvim or even when they are not ktuvim. Tashma, ditmar mishemet v'niach shtei banot ubein echad. A person dies and leaves over 3 children, 2 daughters and 1 son. V'kadma rishona v'natla yisur nechassim. And the first daughter, when she gets married, takes 1/10 of the estate as her dowry, which is an institution of the Chachamim that each daughter is entitled to 1/10 of the estate for her dowry. She goes ahead when she gets married and does that. Rashi over here claims that the daughter is entitled to that either when she goes to get married or when she hits the age of Bagrut. As you can see, Rabbi Kiv Eger already says that Tzarech Iyun Godol on that, because as far as we know, this is only true. Yisur Nechassim is only an entitlement to a girl who gets married. Not just because she reaches the age of Bagrut is she entitled to her Yisur Nechassim. The fact that Rashi mentions that possibility over here is very difficult. Below, he speaks of Shniyad Gavot. The second daughter, who is also entitled to Yisur Nechassim, she did not get married yet, Ad Shemeita Ben. And then the son or their brother passes away. So when the brother passes away, he was the sole inheritor of his father's estate, because he's the son. When he passes away, then the inheritance is going to be split between the 2 daughters. So Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Shni Avitra. The second one basically gave up her right to her Yisur Nechassim. Even though she didn't do anything wrong, But simply by the fact that she did not take it from the estate yet, means that whatever's left in the estate, the two daughters will split evenly. She will not, mirosh, up front, get to take off her 10% and then split it between them, even though the first daughter took 10%. That means that the first daughter is actually going to end up with more of the estate, the 10% for her dowry, plus the splitting of the residual estate with her sister. The other sister will lose out and only get the residual half of the estate. Even greater than this, they said, motzin the parnasa, that you're allowed to, for Isha Nechassim, to go after lekuchot buyers, encumbered property, to pay for the 10% of a dowry. Vein motzin le mizonot, even though you cannot do that for mizonot, meaning that mizonot, as we saw in our Mishnah, you cannot go after encumbered property, only free and clear property. Nevertheless, when it comes to the Isha Nechassim, when it comes to the dowry, the one-tenth of the estate that is granted to the girls, that you can go after encumbered property. And you're telling us now that the second girl gives up her right to get her Nisr Nechassim. She has a lien on the property for this. And if the property was sold, she can go after the buyers and get it. So now you're telling us that she gives it up to her sister? Why would she do that? Nisr Nechassim is something that has a fixed, quantifiable amount. You can know the number of daughters that are in the estate, and each one of them is entitled to 10% of the estate. You can make the calculation and figure out how much is going to go to these daughters, even though it's not written down, because it might be a tnai of the ktubah, or it's an institution of the chachamim, but it's not written explicitly into the document, v'kamotziah, and yet we see that she's entitled to go get it and take it from encumbered property. That would prove to you that Rabbi Chanina's position is that in cases where it's quantifiable, even when it's not written down, you have an entitlement to go after encumbered property. It does not need to be written. The Gemara says, Shani Parnosa, came to eat like Kala, command dichtivadomi. That Parnosa is different. This dowry issue that the girls have that entitlement from the estate is a very public issue, both because when they get married, everybody will know how much is going into the dowry, as well as the fact that it's a well-known issue when one passes away, that he has daughters they're going to take out of the estate. It's as if it's written down, even though it's not literally written down, it's figuratively written down, which means that it's a public issue, and people know about it, and therefore the lekuchot who come to buy know to be aware of that, or wary of that, even though technically it's not written down, it's as if it's written down. And so therefore it doesn't necessarily answer our question as to whether Rabbi Chanina only requires that it be quantifiable, the amount, in order to go after encumbered property? Or does it have to be quantifiable and written down in order to go after that property? Okay, we're going to stop here. 10 lines down on the top of Nun Aleph, Amud Aleph.